Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. And my very special guest today is none other than Rick Osmond. Rick, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Vinnie. How you been?
You know, somewhat fabulous is my standard response, mate. What about yourself?
I'm well, and that's an accomplishment all by itself.
Yeah, it can be, especially when everybody's bathing in that Fukushima radiation. Which is everybody at this point. Now, Rick, would you please be so kind as to explain to myself and the audience just a little bit about yourself and what it is you do?
Well, I'm an author, a magazine writer. I've been a talk show host myself off and on for the last 8 or 9 years. For the Oopa Loopa Cafe, as well as Unraveling the Secrets, and regular on 2 or 3 other shows. But I'm concentrating now on my research that is still growing out of my book, The Graves of the Golden Bear, Ancient Fortresses and Monuments of the Ohio Valley. I don't know how familiar or how far-reaching your audience is, but how familiar they are with North America, but the Ohio Valley and the Mississippi together drain about 2/3 of the United States. So there were a lot
kind
of
like the kind of like the Congress and its expenditure.
Yeah, they drain about 2/3 of everything. That's right. But the drainage basin of those rivers has been the highway system for North America for pretty much as long as there have been people here. However long that is, and the Clovis First argument is dying a slow and agonizing death, because we now have verified dates going back 14, 15, 16, 18, 25,000 years, and a few anomalies that indicate anywhere from 100,000 to 200,000 years. So there have been people around here for a very long time.
We're talking about ancient civilizations and things of that nature. I've interviewed a number of people who talk about Bigfoot and what have you, other primitive creatures waltzing around that people still haven't discovered yet.
They haven't recognized them as a scientifically verified entity, but yeah, they're there, some of them.
Even a former president of the United States, somebody wrote a book, a journal entry or something of this nature, that they were attacked by a group of these creatures. They were surrounded by red eyes looking at them from out of the bush somewhere in Northern California. I forget who it was. It might have been
Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt, yeah.
Yeah, and he did not exactly, well, he did have an encounter of his own, but it wasn't, he was relating the account of the attack. And it was in front of a number of, well, high echelon folks, I guess is how you'd have to say it. It was rather interesting, to say the least. And we've had other high officials who have offered anomalous observations. Jimmy Carter claimed to have seen a UFO. You know, President Obama claims to have a Social Security number. Another, you know, a lot of anomalous stuff like that. My research is a little older than most of that. I'm actually into some of the strange history of the very early United States. And in my book, I concentrate the first three or four or five chapters are about the founding of the colonies in North America, not just by the English, but also by the Spanish and the French, with a high concentration on the French, because they recorded a lot of anomalous things. And a lot of their records actually contain what I perceive to be coded messages. In particular, there's one map by a guy by the name of Delisle, who was the cartographer, geographer royal for King Louis, actually for the regent at that time, because Louis wasn't old enough to, you know, the Dauphine, he wasn't old enough to be king. So they had a regent, but he was preparing and educating the heir to the throne on the geography of the French realm, including New France and what at that time was known as La Louisiane, what we later call the Louisiana Territory here in the United States. But some of his map entries are just weird and not in keeping with an extremely highly educated human being. They, clerical errors that someone like him simply would not make. They had to indicate something was hidden within the narrative itself, or in that case, the legend on the map. We also had the Lewis and Clark expedition that explored that territory, and each the leaders, the both captains, William Clark and Meriwether Lewis, were tasked by President Thomas Jefferson to encode, encipher, if you will, anything that they perceived as a threat to the very young United States, and to send that message back through the river system to the president directly. And they did, apparently, or at least some of the things in the journals certainly appear to use what is called the Grand Cipher, developed by the French in the in the 16th century and went unbroken until the very late 19th century. And even at that, they only broke one page of the cipher because they figured out the key for that particular message. Each message could have its own key, which made it virtually unbreakable. Jefferson used it. He was taught it probably by Lafayette. Both he, Washington, and a number of other of the very early United States politicians and patriots, if you want to use that word, used it for secure communication. And Lewis and Clark used it during their journey, and you can see it in some of the journals, not just by them, but some of the other members of the Corps of Discovery used something like it. I don't have the key, so I can't tell you exactly what they were saying, but certainly they were using a cipher. Mm. It's just kind of interesting that they would do that for, you know, something that was supposedly just a voyage of discovery, you know?
Well, you know, there's many voyages of discovery that have been undertaken by mankind in the past, and most of which were secret because you don't want to let people know that you're trying to discover something important, because then other people will try and discover it as well and stake right. their claim on it.
Right, and that's very similar to what happened with the Spanish, Portuguese, and Columbus, because by many accounts, Columbus actually had a map that was provided by the Portuguese, who turned him down for his first voyage, incidentally. And he ended up going to Spain to get the money. So it's a long-standing tradition to keep the secrets, particularly with regard to important trade routes, which is what North America was. So that's what I'm recording and researching continually.
Yeah.
So does that help?
Yeah, it does. How long have you been doing it, and what got you into it? Because something tells me you could make a hell of a lot of money in your own personal life if you sold your soul and covered stuff that didn't matter.
Well, I've been interested in it since my teenage years. I was 14, maybe 15 years old, when I encountered a couple of the local self-styled historians who told me about a line of forts or fortresses across southern Indiana here in the United States. And at first I thought they were just full of it, you know. But then I started reading up on the history within the Indiana Historical Society, and they were telling me the truth. Two of those fortresses were actually known in the historical record, even though one of them was poo-pooed by the Smithsonian Institution. That was a deliberate attempt to cover up something that was very real and mattered. And the reason it mattered, because the local legend near Louisville, Kentucky, or on the Indiana side, it's Charlestown, Indiana, was that this fortress was built by the ancient Welsh who came here. One version says 1170 AD, and the other one says 570 AD. In either case, they would have been led by Celtic Christians, or Chaldees, as they're known there. And that would have meant that there were Christians in America before Columbus, which would, under the papal bull of 1452, the one that both the Spanish and the Portuguese used to claim lands in Americas, the claims would have been invalid because there were already Christians in America. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm coming from on the whole conspiracy side and why all the governments, England, Spain, France, United States, perhaps even the Netherlands, knew this and chose to ignore it and cover up parts of it deliberately. So that's what my book's about. And my ongoing research is on some of the things that I touched on in the book about just how sophisticated these people were who governed and probably taxed, tithed, controlled the traffic on the rivers. So that's what I'm researching right now, is not only who they were, when they were doing it, but what technologies did they use to communicate?
Do you have a working thesis? What do you think happened before you've done your research?
They used line of sight communications with light, both day and night, and they had different technologies for whether it was period of darkness or period of daylight. In the daylight, they used reflectors to reflect sunlight, just like the United States Army did in the late 19th century, what they called a heliograph. It would bounce sunlight through a shuttered device and used Morse code just like a telegraph, but it was light. And they documented a path over 270 miles as their most successful that the United States Army could set up. And this was with portable equipment. If you had fixed installations, as the ancients did, you could conceivably send a message from the East Coast of America to the Mississippi River in an afternoon.
That's quite sophisticated there.
It is quite sophisticated.
And where did they come up with this with these methodologies and tech?
That's a really good question. The same thing was going on at the same time in Britain and throughout the Roman Empire with a slightly different technology, but they were doing it. They had polished metal mirrors in the old world, and in the new world they had a natural thing called mica, which essentially makes a very good mirror all by itself. In, I want to say it's Ipswich, but I'd have to look up the exact name of the town. They found an ancient Roman lantern, 1st century BC up to about 1st century AD in design. This one's actually been repaired. In ancient times, it had already been broken and repaired, but it used, the archaeologists tried to claim they used a shaved cow horn as a wind screen for a natural oil lantern. And the reality is the Romans were extremely good with glass, and it probably looked a whole lot like a Coleman lantern, but with a shutter on it. And the shutter would have made it a signal device throughout the British Isles, throughout Gaul, as they called it.
So it could be closed and opened rapidly, allowing it to be used for some sort of Morse code, perhaps?
Correct. And I'm certain that's what it did. By the design of the frame on it, it certainly had something that was used like a shutter. Now, when it was lost and crushed, it probably had already lost its shutter. Like I said, it had already been repaired once. So it was probably a toss off as far as the signaling device, but it would still been a good lantern, if you will. Good lighting device. In North America, you find literally thousands of high points along rivers and not near rivers. Some of them artificial, some of them natural, that show signs of vitrification of the soil, meaning they had a rather large and very hot fire at one time. That's not all they use for signals. But at night, they had to make light, and they probably did it with a fire. Well, I'm pretty certain they did it with a fire. Just how big and what type and how did they direct it and how did they pulse it, if you will? How did they make a code out of it?
They weren't just using it for partying, you know, running around the big fire naked and drumming and so on and forth.
Well, yeah, they did that too, but not at
those. So it's a dual-purpose signal fire.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Look at this, boys. We could use this to communicate and get wasted.
Yeah, pretty much. They had plenty of materials for that, too. They made pipes. It wasn't all for tobacco. They had probably at least 43 different natural plants that were mind-altering in one way or another, some hallucinogenic, some simply psychotropic. And then they had various combinations. Everybody had their own blend. And some of the pipes that have been recovered in an archaeological context, meaning, you know, the farmer who found it didn't use it, but the archaeologist who found it sent it to a laboratory, and they've been able to isolate some of the compounds in it. It's pretty interesting what those folks could do.
Well, it sounds like they're not entirely dissimilar from the rest of humanity today. You know, you go over, you explore new things and make discoveries, and then you get high to celebrate.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. They also had, and here I'm talking Native Americans, they also had at least two or three different forms of alcoholic drink. They had a corn beer, which was probably awful by our standards, but hey, you know, drink what you got. I mean, you guys get Foster's too, right?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. I've had Norwegian Christmas beer too.
Christmas beer?
Yeah, it's a
what is that, tradition. Like eggnog and vodka?
No, it's a home-brewed beer. Once in a great while, somebody does a good job. Most of the time, they do not.
Okay.
But they don't brew, home-brew real good beer in Norway.
And I'm or at not least a fan the people you yet. Know.
That, correct.
You need some new friends, yo. You need some new friends.
I have visited there 9 times, and I still have not found all the things or visited all the places that I would like to in Norway, because there is a lot of history there with regard to North America and my research.
Well, how so?
Leif Erikson, son of Erik the Red, founder of the colonies in Greenland, was run out of Norway for murder. He was banished. He was run out of Iceland for murder, and he was banished, and he formed a colony in Greenland. Well, part of that banishment included his sons, plural, but Leif in particular, became a ward of the King of Norway. And later on, Leif was tasked by the king to go to Greenland and find out just why the hell they weren't paying their taxes and tribute and tithes and stuff. And to make sure that they were indeed Christians, which Erik wasn't. But while he was in Greenland, he heard about this land to the west, Vinland. Well, he didn't know it was Vinland then. He called it Vinland when he got back, but he visited North America. And a colony was established in Vinland. Well, hold on. There's that Christians in North America before Columbus thing again. So the practicality is probably never get anything changed, but the bare bones legal thing is all the claims were illegal.
Well, this is this is something that's pretty widely accepted among people, that there were kind of like sort of Viking people and what have you coming into America pre-Columbus. Isn't that just kind of mainstream now? There's even been a movie about it starring the New Zealander Carl Urban called Pathfinder about
this. That was a great movie, I thought. It was a little far-fetched because the Vikings didn't have ships with holds in them. They had longboats. That was the main, in my opinion, main faux pas of that motion picture. But the idea that Norse and or Vikings, which Vikings were just Norse who were down on their luck and wanted to, you know, use somebody else's money for a while or go party real hardy in Britain usually.
So they were kind of the socialists of their day.
In a way they were. You know, you've got it and I want it. So here, meet my sword.
Yeah. And the problem is eventually you run out of everybody else's money to waste.
Exactly. That's what Ronald Reagan said too. But
Reagan and the Vikings, they were like this.
Yes. It's like dinosaur hugs. But the Vikings, if you will, probably were not, almost certainly were not Leif Erikson or any of the party in any of the members in that party that founded Vinland, founded and lived in Vinland for some period of time, which meets a criteria of a colony, which kind of negates the whole papal bull thing.
What happened to them? Did they die out? Did they intermarry with local Indian tribes? And then the stories weren't passed down of proper historical records. What happened to the colony?
The colony was abandoned when they got into it with some of the locals. Not all of them. I don't think that Vinland was the only colony. It's the only one that actually got a written record called the Vinland Saga. It was written in, I want to say, 1106, so it was, you know, some time afterwards, by Snorri Snorrason of Iceland, who wrote it down for the first time. Therefore, the historians say, well, that's not valid because it was passed down word of mouth. Well, really? For 100 years?
Do you think all ancient cultures recorded their historical events other than word of mouth, you know?
That's exactly right. But that doesn't matter much to historians because it's not a written record from the get-go.
Well, their asinine argument doesn't hold any weight, I think.
I concur with that. You know, Napoleon Bonaparte said history is but a fiction agreed upon. And
sounds
he
about right.
Would be in a position to know, which, by the way, is a quote at the very front of my book.
Well, there you go. Now, moving on from that, I mean, it would be interesting to find out, like, the discrepancies between written records and what we call word-of-mouth records and what have you, because there's not only stories of ancient America and what have you, we've even found footprints in stone, human footprints next to dinosaur footprints, and they were laid about the same time. There was some creek bed in the States somewhere.
Glen Rose, Texas.
Yeah, yes. That's the one.
And Dr. Hugh Miller has, and his son, went on after that discovery. They went on to excavate further up that creek bed, separate that layer of rock further up with witnesses and photography and videography and, you know, whole thing, and they found more. So it's not like it's completely unrepeatable.
I've been coming to a conclusion just of recent times, Rick, and maybe you'll vibe with this as well, is when you're trying to explain anything to quote-unquote reductionist thinkers, mm-hmm. It comes to the point where they don't believe evidence is evidence. You find soil samples, rock samples, historical records, written stuff, passed down stories and everything like that, and it doesn't fit with their narrative, so they go, nah, it doesn't count as evidence, nah.
Right. And that's kind of the unscience part of the scientific method. Whereas, as an example, you take carbon-14 or radiocarbon testing. of samples of organic materials. And let's say you get a dozen of them and five of them fit your paradigm. You throw out the rest because they don't fit the paradigm. We only keep the five bits of evidence that support your theory or your hypothesis. Wait a minute. I thought the data was supposed to drive the theory rather than vice versa. So when, as Dr. U. Miller did, when you retrieve some radiocarbon containing biological material from a dinosaur bone that couldn't possibly have a radiocarbon signature if it was more than 40, 50,000 years old, there's something wrong with the paradigm.
Well, there's more things that are wrong with the paradigm than are right with it, isn't it? Something occurred to me as well is that this isn't an accident, you know, that people think this way, or rather can't think in that particular vein, is because certain people taught them what to think, how to reason, etc. And I believe that the education system has been structured in such a way to prevent free thinking and to prevent a reliance on factual evidence, and instead rely mostly on authority figures for their information, because authorities obviously are never wrong or lie or abuse their power. And that's basically the end of the story. You got taught by a bunch of people who have an interest in making sure that you can't think, and so that when somebody who does and can think comes along and tells you something you're not prepared for, you think, ironically, that they're the one who's stupid and can't think. And not you.
Yeah. I recently read a piece, a debunking piece, if you will, by an archaeologist who said, oh, all these diffusionists, they're just a bunch of groupthink. They get an idea and everybody wants to share that idea. It's like, really? Because that's exactly what I think about archaeologists. If it's not the same as you think, it's wrong. So, and
is this part of like an obsession to be correct? You know, I don't like being correct. That, I like being corrected more.
Yeah, I like learning. And if I'm only dictating, then I'm not learning. The other thing that I find very interesting about archaeologists is once they retire, they'll say, oh, no, it's not a science. We just like to say it is. That's also in my book. I got a whole chapter about that.
There's actually quite a few fields of science that aren't science. Psychiatry, for instance.
As an example, yeah. One of the greatest physicists, particle physicists, any kind of physics, actually, Richard Feynman, he just had a ball any time that there was a psychology minor in his physics class, because he'd say, really? You call that an experiment? And then he'd proceed to tear him apart.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a good point to leave the first segment. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back after the break with Rick Osman. Back in a minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you will go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest, who is a specialist in some of the madness, namely, he goes up against it, people who are incapable of reasoning, like historians, ironically. Rick Osman, welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, it is one of my favorite pastimes. And there's no end to, you know, new versions of the insanity and whatnot. There was a very famous, very adept diffusionist whose, you know, day job was she was a lawyer and a judge. In particular, she tried cases of intellectual property, patent, copyright, etc. Her name was Henrietta Mertz, and she used the Latin phrase ipsi dixit to describe some of this "because I said so" stuff. And it was an infamous phrase for many years. People had just about forgotten Henrietta now, and that's too bad all by itself, because she was an amazing person, did amazing work. She was challenged by another judge to do a mock trial of diffusion versus Columbus discovery first. Well, Columbus lost his case in a big way. And if that were done today, it would almost certainly have the same result. And it does have that result, particularly within the popular press, so to speak, your show included. The believers here outnumber the non-believers as far as diffusion. Probably.
Could you define diffusion just for the uneducated? This would include me as well.
Okay, diffusion, cultural diffusion in particular, there's a number of versions of it. Cultural diffusion would be, for instance, we're using the same tools. I'm guessing you're using a PC with probably Microsoft Windows.
Mac.
Similar technology, different rich guy.
Pretty much.
But the running all the same programs, they just run a little differently. And that's another parallel between the North American version of the line of sight communications and the old world version, which the Romans did not invent. Incidentally, they took it from somebody they conquered, probably Carthage.
May I offer an interjection?
Sure.
Because the invention of the telescope, I think, was 9 different people at different sides of the earth on the same night came up with the same invention.
Well, that's one version of the interpretation. Let's go back a little further to the Maya in the Yucatan. There's actually a stele, a phrase, of a Mayan looking through a telescope at the stars. And that culture pretty much died out by 1000 AD. And supposedly they barely had metal working technology, let alone optics working technology.
Well, I think there's two elements here, and I totally agree with what you're talking about, because not only is there suppressed, ancient, / forgotten about technology, but there's also ancient, suppressed, forgotten about abilities of human beings.
Certainly. The intellectual level of the ancients probably outstrips us by several orders of magnitude. Hmm. I mentioned Jefferson as an example with the cryptography. He held a different key for each correspondent, and he held that key in his head and never screwed up any of the communication. How difficult would that be? He probably had some system that worked well for him, and he just kept it, but he never conveyed it to anyone except each individual correspondent had their own key, which they probably had to write down and keep secret. Whereas he could keep it in his head.
Well, what kind of keys are these? Are these harmonics or?
No, actually, with the grand cipher, typically, and this is at the very general level of it, a single syllable has a set of digits, a numerical number, if you will, that represents a syllable. Now, in French, you know, they have a certain number of syllables. In English, we have a certain number of syllables that we use all the time. But if you use the same key with each of the syllables all the time, then you would not have a secure code. Somehow or another, Jefferson and Lafayette and Washington and Adams and a bunch of the others were able to keep keys for individual correspondence. That made it a lot easier to track the spies because it would only go one way to one person. And if you sent the same message to a different person, it would come up different. That's where it gets really interesting on Jefferson.
Could you elaborate further on that? Do you know any more pieces to the puzzle there?
I can elaborate to the extent that during the Corps of Discovery venture west, that Lewis and Clark were teaching other members of the Corps of Discovery to use this code, and it shows up in the journals of those other members. For instance, in one account, I believe it was September the 10th, 1804. I could be wrong on the date, but you had three different journal entries about they discovered the skeleton of a giant fish on the banks of the river, 45 feet long. And each entry was very similar or almost exact, except for one, Mr. Gass, who elaborated and were taking a sample of the bones to send back to Washington City. There's another example of not everybody got the same message. Now, with the grand cipher in the French realm, for instance, the artillery general would get one message using a key that was for him. And the artillery general would get one for him, and the cavalry would get one for him, and the admiral would get a different one. So that whoever was running a war could send an individual message to each of the others and guarantee that if there was a spy, not all would get the same message exactly.
That reminds me of a chapter in Sun Tzu's The Art of War. When communicating to your own troops, it's best to put incorrect information into your own troops' hands. That way you'll be able to find out who the traitors are and also have nobody know what the real plan is until the commander gives the order at the opportune time.
Correct. Sun Tzu knew that 5,000 years ago, or I'm sorry, 3,100 years ago.
So we're talking about a technological advent that's based upon an ancient military practice.
And psychology that goes back 3 millennia.
Wow. So we're talking about something from the dawn of man, or was there some point throughout human history where suddenly, boom, everything changed and we got all this technology like the ancient alien theory suggests?
I'm not a believer in the ancient alien theory. I am a believer that man has always been intellectually adept. For instance, could you go get in a boat, I don't care what size it is, and navigate your way to the United States or any place else across an ocean without a GPS, without a sextant, without a Lorentz sea or any of the modern navigational aids?
Nah, you'd be screwed.
No, not if you knew how they did it. And they told us how they did it.
Well, just they navigated watched. By the stars.
Yes, they navigated by the stars completely. And you still can because, well, okay, they've changed a little bit. They changed completely in 12,000 years, give or take. And they come back full circle in about 26.4, actually. So it's not an unknown thing. The technology has always been there, and people were navigating and sailing at least 40,000 years ago to get to Australia, and probably 30,000 years ago to get to New Zealand, although Moray tend to disagree with that.
And of course, this is just based upon the artifacts that we can currently unearth. There may be artifacts even deeper and older. We could conceivably be going back millions of years, right?
Well, certainly the oldest tools that have been found outside of Africa, to my knowledge, are about 120,000 years old. And they were on Crete. And they didn't walk there either. They had to sail. So somebody was sailing the Med 120,000 years ago. somebody, if, you know, conceivably you could have walked to North America at one time, but you could not walk to Crete. You couldn't walk to Australia or New Zealand. Even when the height of the ice age had the sea level 300 to 600 feet lower in some places, it was still deep ocean between those two bodies of land and the main body of land.
I believe also people have been claiming that there was some form of supercontinent in the Pacific, and New Zealand's like at the tip of it, and the rest of it stretches all the way north to like Hawaii and then across to Easter Island or something of that nature, like that little kind of big triangle allegedly used to be some form of enormous landmass. And divers, I think, off the coast of Japan and quite a number of countries have.
Yeah, Yonaguni in particular, which is the southernmost tip of the Japanese archipelago and is almost within sight of Shanghai. I'm sorry, not Shanghai, Taipei. It's almost within sight of Formosa, if you want to call it that, the island off the People's Republic of China, which is, you know, free China, so to speak. Anyway, they that particular monumental megalithic work is 90 feet underwater. But 15,000 years ago, it could have been as much as 200 feet above sea level, maybe more. It was essentially a hilltop, and it was worked by hand, probably with metal to almost certainly with metal tools and a great deal of engineering acuity.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was somebody working stuff here on this planet a long time ago, and I'm convinced they were human. Maybe not Homo sapiens sapien like us, but they were human and they were smart. Cro-Magnon as an example. Cro-Magnon is a forerunner, an early version of us. But he was, you know, as much as 7.5-8 feet tall, and his brain case to body mass was bigger even than that by about 10%. He was potentially super intelligent. And he probably started things like, oh, I don't know, the copper culture and sailed and traded and made pottery and farmed and animal husbandry and all those things that people say
quite a lot of evidence of that. I believe a goat skin map of South America, the east side of South America, the southeast of the United States, and just the very, very west of Africa. So somebody had a map on goat skin that was drawn pretty much accurate to the measurement to our modern maps today, and they had Africa, North America, and South America on that map with trade routes plotted out on it.
And Antarctica.
Oh, yeah. Now I remember, yeah.
Perry Reese, who supposedly drew that map in, I believe it was 1507, and he was a Turkish admiral. But he should not have been privy to South America, North America, or Antarctica. Africa was pretty well known 5,000 years ago. Its general shape, its dimensions, etc. The ancient Egyptians paid the Phoenicians, Mano specifically, to circumnavigate Africa. And he did. It took him 3.5 years. But it's in the Egyptian histories. So people have been sailing with some acumen for a very long time. Now back to the navigation stuff. What tools did they use? Well, I think that is in the old art, and it'll be in my next book. So stay tuned.
There's lots more to come. And the best part about having your profession based upon hundreds of thousands of years, etc., of human history and whatnot, is that you never run out of material for new books because there's hundreds of thousands of years worth of it.
Correct. Also, I'm writing for Ancient American Magazine, and started with a number of the fortresses I investigated in my book, but also the line of sight communications network. And they kind of go hand in hand because one supported the other and vice versa. So of the 45 stone fortresses that I've identified, well, and a lot of the antiquarians of the 19th century identified them before me. Nevertheless, they are out there and I can write for that magazine for years and never get off topic.
There is that much information out there, and it's funny, we should get onto just how much there is, because I was thinking just about a minute ago as you were speaking, some people might be wondering at this point, well, what's the point? We've got ancient people, blah, 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 blah. What does that really change? Does it make any difference knowing these things today?
Particularly with regard to the navigation? Yes, because as soon as there is the next coronal mass ejection from the sun, the next time the sun decides to burp in our direction, the GPS, all the electronic devices go dead. They are never to be resurrected in our lifetime again, probably. So the old methods will be the only methods we can use.
Well, in this case, you're talking about kind of like a ancient survivalist school kind of thing.
Well, in essence, yeah. The old methods will still work because it's not going to destroy the Earth or change its rotation rate or its position in the solar system. So our navigation, if we want to cross oceans, and oh, by the way, if you still want to drink coffee, you'll have to get it from someplace else. Because I don't believe they have coffee beans in New Zealand, do they?
Yeah, we do, actually. We've got a coffee plantation on Waiheke Island that's just off the coast of Auckland, a 35-minute ferry ride.
Then that'll be the next generation's Bill Gates.
Oh, yeah.
Because nobody can do without their coffee once they're
nobody.
Hooked on, like, an IR.
Nobody. I mean, dude, I was driving down the road with my wife just the other day, and we were talking about how easy some substances and drugs are easy to, like, give up or not do. You know, like, it's not that difficult to just decide I'm not going to have a cigarette today. It's not that difficult to say, no, I'm not going to buy that bottle of liquor. It's not that difficult to refuse a puff on a joint. But to not have your coffee in the morning, there are immediate consequences. Headaches.
For society, not just for the individual.
A friend of mine who I knew when I was quite young, around 19, he ran a company, and he was drinking at least 6 espressos a day and then gave up cold turkey. He fired 2 employees that day.
Yeah.
Now, does that strike you as something that's actually a little bit scary? I mean, what happens when the coffee runs out, bro? Are we going to have, like, really, really angry people everywhere?
Well, for a short time we will, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how long do the effects last? Because I tried to give up coffee for an entire week and the symptoms didn't leave me.
If you can survive 6 weeks or so, you'll be over it.
6 weeks of aggro. Sweet mercy.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that.
Oh, my God.
And I hope I never have to find out. I hope nobody around me ever has to find out.
You know, I mean, that's it. I'm going down to one of those illegal grow stores and I'm getting myself a coffee hydroponics kit, you know. You'd be like secretly growing coffee in your spare room and stuff like that, hoping nobody finds out about it.
Probably a law against it, but...
Yeah. no, but then again, how... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's an analogy, if you will. The United States was formed because of a very similar dependence upon tea. And the taxation upon that tea. And we told King George, hey, screw you. We're going to get our tea elsewhere.
And it wasn't just King George. It was the Dutch East India Trading Company.
Which
incidentally, I believe it went under a corporate merger or something and then just started to... It started all these other companies like the Queen and Wright of New Zealand, for example. Which is
one example.
Yeah. And I think there's company names for England, and all the countries basically became corporations, more or less. And I think
this they already were.
Yeah.
They already were in reality. They just took a different legal form. The Virginia Company was founded to exploit tobacco and sell it in the old world, tobacco being a new world plant. And it made it, guns and a few other commodities like whiskey, made the United States rich in its infancy. Now we're paying the price for a little bit of overindulgence, not in those products, but in the money that came from them. We also had copper. During the 19th century, we mined someplace around 50 million pounds of copper from Lake Superior region.
It was the cheapest metal at the time in the United States.
And it was overabundant. It was overabundant, and it was very near the top of the ground, and it was very nearly pure. And it wasn't the first round of mining it either. People have mined it for 9,000 years. You know, before there was a copper culture, according to the historians and archaeologists, people were mining copper in the Lake Superior region.
Incidentally, the world's first professional police force, the NYPD, had a very low budget when they first started up, and the cheapest available metal that they could get and cut into badges was roofing copper. And so everybody started calling them coppers, which later got shortened to cops.
Bingo. You got it.
Now, when we talk about the United States in and of itself, your speciality is it seems to me quite varied. You can talk about ancient America, Middle America, Revolutionary America, and the origins and the of the species, more or less. Would that be about right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good rundown.
Could I ask you what's your favorite period then when talking about American history, whether it be ancient all the way up to modern?
My very favorite period of history would be the early Americas, early United States, I should say, up to about 1820, 1830, someplace in there. Because even though we had historians and newspapers and all that stuff, there's still a lot of stuff that's hidden. And 1820, 1818 specifically, is when Indiana, as a state, acquired the rest of Indiana from the Native Americans. And up until that time, it was white settlers versus natives, or natives versus white settlers. And it was a back and forth. It was a shooting war for basically 200 years before that. When the French were here, it was more of a trade war thing. And all the English settlers were on the East Coast. Indiana was settled by 1735. When I say settled, it was one town settled by whites. And then the natives built a town around it to trade with the French. It's named for Marquis de Vincennes, who was actually burned at the stake by a different set of Indians. And he didn't found the town of Vincennes, but it was named for him in his honor and his memoriam as a dead guy. And he traded in Buffalo Heights.
Oh, is that right? Well, a slaughterer of buffalo gets burned at the stake. You know,
for invading a different country, in essence. He went into Arkansas and the Osage killed him, burned him at the stake.
I love that line from The Matrix. Fate, it seems, is not without a sense of irony.
It now, certainly had that.
Rick Osmond is my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen. This episode is sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn. Also, the Gourmet Soup Kitchen in Wagga Wagga. Wagga Wagga. If you go down and like click the little banner there and you go to that website, oh my god, they got some nice looking soap, bro. Honestly, it's like jewelry for your filthy body. Go get some of that stuff. We'll be right back.